Yeah, so the overlap is the arouse time, obviously, and how important it is. So as indicated in the program, my talk is going to be on the separability criteria for entangled polymer liquids. The work was done with several former graduate students, but in particular one new graduate student, Javier Sanchez-Reyes, who's a third year PhD student. And in this audience, there's perhaps not a need, there's not a need for a lot of preamble to this type of experiment. Basically, the observation is that if one imposes a step strain on a polymer liquid, a step strain is a deformation where the material's at rest at some point in time indicated here, you apply a very sudden, rapid deformation, and you maintain the strain constant at some value gamma forever, for a long period of time. The stress responds by increasing at a time the strain is imposed because the shear rate is very large. When the strain is kept constant, the stress decays because the shear rate is zero. Now, the very nice thing, I think, about step strain experiments is that they're imposed so quickly that they perturb many, many relaxation modes. In theory, all. In practice, there's some limitation because of the finite time required to impose a step strain. Now, once the strain is imposed, then one can actually study this sort of the array of relaxation processes by monitoring the relaxation modulus, GT of gamma, the so-called nonlinear modulus, which is the stress divided by the imposed strain gamma, as a function of time, and typically you get results that look like I've indicated here. Now, what has been observed is that if you look at the data, particularly at long time, you notice that results collected at different strains are sort of parallel to each other, indicating that if you shift the curves along the vertical axis, they should superimpose, and the consequence or that effort is shown on the right-hand side, where in fact one finds that a superposition occurs after some finite time, lambda k, that is referred to as the separability time. The material in this particular example is a 6% volume polystyrene in diethyl phthalate. The number of entanglements are about 8, and I use this formula to calculate the entanglement molecular weight. The relaxation time is about 7.4 seconds. The point is that you find that the factorability or the separability occurs well below the reptation time. Okay? Now, this is this type of factorability is in fact quite common for narrow distribution polymers. For polydispersed materials, often the factorability time is undetectable, meaning for the entire range of time accessible on a rheometer, for example, the material appears to be factorable. Now, the question of what controls this factorability time is actually a very old question in rheology. But the sort of new impetus to answer that question came with the Doe-Edwards model that actually assigned a molecular process to this time. In particular, that model said that the molecular process responsible for this this time is essentially unhindered motion of a test chain in a tube or free Rouse diffusion in the tube. And this is as a result engendered quite a bit of interest on the experimental side to decide whether this is indeed true. Now, I was going to tell you a little bit about the model, but I'm going to do that fairly quickly. So this is sort of the Doe-Edwards model. The assumptions, the main assumption, is that stress built up in flow relaxes by two main processes. There's a fast process, the Rouse process, and that's related to this separability. And then there's a slow process where molecules diffuse to lose orientation by reptational diffusion. Now, one could actually put equations to that set of rules, and the equations are fairly well known. The end result, as pointed out by Mansfield a minute ago, is an expression of this type for the stress tensor, namely that it's related to two things, the average length of the tube squared times the orientation tensor that in the Dou-Edwards theory is a universal tensor. Now, the theory of Doyle and Edwards contends that the process by which length relaxes is a Rouse process, and consequently, after retraction is over, you would expect that this universal tensor, the universal orientation tensor, should be what determines relative differences in relaxation moduli at different strains. And since the orientation tensor is universal, the strain-dependent part should actually be independent of material measure. Okay, so the damping function predicted by this model is a universal function. Now, the initial results collected primarily by Osaki's group were just sort of brilliant, very much consistent with the model prediction. In particular, what was observed experimentally was, in fact, very nice superposition at some early time tau k. And I'll show you in a few minutes, the molecular weight dependencies and concentration dependence of this value appear to scale quite well with, to compare quite well with the expectations for a Rouse process. What's more important is that a damping function, the strain-dependent function required to accomplish this shifting, H of gamma, was found to be in very good agreement with the predictions of the Dou-Edwards independent alignment model, the DASH model. And these results are lifted directly from Doyle and Edwards' book, as you can perhaps tell. Yes?
I wonder if you might, Osaki's experiments preceded the model, and I suspect they were inspiration for the derivation in the Polymer Journal.
I'll leave that for the question and answer period. How about that? Because I don't know. That's a complicated question. But it's a good one. So the... very soon after these first sort of, in my view, heady days, because if I were writing the model and it worked so well, this would have been really very good, all right? Considering that people had spent 30 years more or less floundering to find a model suitable for describing the strain dependence of stress that was truly universal, parameter-free. But then problems started to emerge. The problems emerged when it was observed that there are basically two types of entangled polymer liquids. One type of polymer liquid, indicated on the left, displayed the damping function characteristic of the Doyle and Edwards theory mentioned earlier. Namely, there was this sort of confluence of the strain-dependent moduli to a point that was some n times the longest Rouse relaxation time for the polymer in question. Now, n started off being about 4 or 5. And it's now crept up to, I think, 20 at the last reading. I smile because it just underscores the discussion yesterday that there's a really strong need for a way of determining the longest Rouse relaxation time. And this, it was contended, this type of damping where one found at least a correlation, even with a large prefactor, between the separability time and tau Rouse, Osaki claimed was characteristic of materials with the concentration times the molecular weight of order 10 to the 6 grams per centimeter cubed. Now, subsequent work by my group, my student Muhammad Islam, showed that this, when translated into entanglement densities in the case of polystyrene, this type of damping was typically found in materials with M over ME in the vicinity of about 11. So very modest numbers. At the opposite limit were polymers that did not show this type of damping behavior, and in fact showed factorability only after a much delayed time, as indicated here, of order the reptation time, or the terminal time of the polymer. Now, again, this behavior was first reported by Osaki and co-workers, and it was contended there that CM for these types of materials should be in the vicinity of 10 to the 6th grams per centimeter cubed. Our subsequent work suggests that this type of behavior occurs at about 13 entanglements per molecule, which is actually quite modest, indicating that perhaps the separability time very quickly, as entanglement density increases, very quickly deviates from the longest Rouse relaxation time. And the question of my talk is basically why? Why is this the case, all right? Not to answer it, but to ask you that question. Now, yes. Well, that's typically what's observed, yes. Are they only separable when the time dependence is exponential?
Single exponential.
And that's typically what's observed.
What's the question about the dispersion?
Say this again?
The dispersion calculus melts, it's 8 million, right?
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't like the word polydispersity because I once sat through a talk by someone who understood that notion, and MW over MN does not tell you polydispersity. All right, and in fact, if you do an elementary chemistry course on anionic polymerization, you will learn that the larger the molecular weight, the greater the error in associating MW over MN and polydispersity. But with that said, it's 1.2. All right, for this polymer, it's a very high molecular weight polymer, and there might be a role for polydispersity, but we'll get to that.
We'll
get to that, yes. The criterion appears to be related more to the entanglement density than anything else.
If you shift your lambs of K up to the point where all those cross and argue that there's some anomaly where they, at longer times where they cross, do you get something that's in better agreement with the Rousey?
Yes, I will talk about that. Yeah. So Ron's question is a good question, because what one finds in addition to this sort of unusual kind of relaxation is that the damping functions also fall into two camps. In particular, materials with entanglement densities less than about 11, and in the Saki notation, CM less than 10 to the sixth, tend to fall quite nicely on the prediction of the universal damping function of the Doi-Edwards independent alignment theory. When one goes to materials with a higher entanglement density, one typically observes a deviation from HDEIA, and the deviation tends to be largest at lower strengths, right? Which is kind of unusual. I mean, all the usual artifacts you would expect from a rheology point of view typically show up at high strengths. You'd expect them to be more important there. But the deviations are curiously seen in these systems at lower strength. So why is it we all are so programmed to think that lambda k is the longest Rouse relaxation time? Well, there were some very nice experiments done by Osaki and co-workers that I think initially appeared to resolve this issue. And what these experiments involved were essentially determining this so-called separability time, lambda k, its ratio to the longest time, tau 1 naught, as a function of m over me. And what the authors found is that the slope of this graph is 1.5, indicating that it is associated with the Rouse relaxation time, that is lambda k. Similar results appeared on a more sort of comprehensive, is that clear? People are puzzled. Okay. Why not 1.4? Why not 1.3 here?
Well.
Yes, it's. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Ah, yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I missed that distinction. Yeah, we've changed. And a larger collection of data appeared in a later paper by Osaki that seemed to reinforce this view that indeed the ratio of tau 1 naught and tau k is actually close to, versus m over me, is close to this 1.5 parallel, consistent with Rouse-like behavior. Our concern started when we discovered that several of the materials in this plot were actually those that should be in type 2. And so obviously they shouldn't be in this plot, because the separability itself would suggest that these things aren't separable on time scales of order to Rouse. So why this correspondence to the Rouse scaling? Well, it turns out that there are several ways to attribute separability. And the approach taken by Osaki is slightly different than what is generally believed to be the way to determine or decide separability for the high molecular weight case. For the low molecular weight case, the approach is sound. For the high molecular weight case, the authors basically take this knee or this kink in the curve to indicate lambda k. And so this is why the data is Rouse-like, the lesson being that this kink is somehow associated with the Rouse process, even though overall the dynamics may not be factorable on Rouse-like scales. Now, so I said that in a few lines, but that took us a lot of years to understand. So basically what my group did was actually try to impose the separability determination more stringently. And we've now done this for a variety of different materials. The panel on the left gives the separability time as well as viscosity and terminal time and lots of other things versus molecular weight. And these measurements were done using polystyrenes of constant concentration, about 18%, and variable molecular weight. And what one finds is that the separability time, lambda k, now gotten rigorously, increases with molecular weight, actually over a fairly broad range of molecular weight, as a power of molecular weight to about a 3.2. Somewhat lower than the result for the viscosity and terminal time, but substantially higher than you would expect for the longest Rouse time. And we decided, just out of interest, to do the alternative case where we just got lambda k from the kink without strictly enforcing factorability, and found that in that case, the factorability time indeed goes roughly as the square of molecular weight. There's a slightly stronger exponent, which again is consistent with a Rouse-like process. We've recently done experiments, more extensive experiments, on solutions, polystyrene solutions in diethyl talate. And this work is now under submission to the Journal of Rheology, where we've actually now compared the terminal properties and the separability time versus concentration for a wide variety of polystyrenes of different concentrations. And what we find again is that the magnitude of this separability time, lambda k, is quite similar to the, I've got things switched. All right, so read lambda r where I have lambda k, and lambda k where I have lambda r. So the magnitude of lambda k is actually quite similar to that of the terminal time, and the scaling with concentration is substantially stronger than you would expect for the longest Rouse time. The magnitude of lambda r is substantially lower than expected for the terminal time, and scales with concentration as about the concentration to the 0.7 power, which is slightly stronger than you would expect for the longest Rouse relaxation time as well. Now this morning, I was puzzled by this for some time, and this morning I ran into Christos, and he said, that's clear, it's obvious, right? Because the normal way to extract the Rouse time, scaling with concentration, is to divide the viscosity scaling by 4, or minus, subtract 4 from it, right? Subtract 4 from the viscosity scaling and you get the Rouse scaling. Now, he didn't see this data, and he just said that. And it turns out to be quite close to what we've got here, suggesting that this weak 0.65 or 0.7 scaling with concentration may in fact be consistent with what is expected in the older literature that I don't know for a Rouse process. So the lesson here is that there are still two times. Well, maybe we can ask him afterwards, because I didn't know this and was surprised that he got it right. So I'm more impressed by that than whether it's correct or not. All right, so, but at any rate, so the point I'm making is that there are two time scales. There's a very fast process that seems to be Rouse-like. But that process is accompanied, in the case of highly entangled systems, by a slower process that looks terminal. And the question is why, all right? The point is that if separability arises from stretching, chain stretching, then the dynamics of chain stretching are answered in some sense by knowing what the separability time is. As a rheologist, I mean, working with highly entangled polymer systems, especially in nonlinear settings, there are artifacts everywhere, all right? In particular, there are many artifacts that can arise from slip violations of the interface. You can have instrument compliance, you can have edge fracture, You can have second, you can have lots of things, all right, that make your results not believable to yourself. We believe actually the most severe of these violations arises from slip. And the reason for that is that slip is driven by distress. And so the slip or the magnitude of slip violations can so closely mimic the stress that you can observe time dependence in distress that appear to be material characteristics, but they really are interfacial features, all right? One way to resolve that issue is to make what are called gap-dependent experiments. Now, we wanted to run these experiments at constant strain, and so a better way to do that is to do cone-angle-dependent experiments and decide whether the damping function is indeed a function of cone angle. That is one way of guaranteeing that slip is not an issue. Now, here I show you results gotten from such an experiment for cone angles ranging from 1 degree to 5 degree, and the diameter of the cones used in these experiments are all identical. They're all 50 millimeter diameter cones, meaning very large cones, which allows you, in fact, to get the details of the long time response needed to identify fracturability. And basically, the result is that there is some small dependence on cone angle. In fact, if you look at the data, you'll see that as I get towards the largest cone angle, the circles, the results seem to approach the HDEIA. So there's some evidence that there's slip in these measurements, but the lesson is that the slip cannot be large because I'm going for 50 millimeter diameter cones from 1 degree angles to 5 angles, a very large difference in gap, but yet there's a very small difference in the damping function. All right? Now if... well, that's we'll get to that later, all right? The filled circles, I can say that quickly. The filled circles are the short time damping. Okay, and this is the reason I put this up here is that I'm going to talk about theories for this behavior in a minute. Lambda Rouse, yeah, but the damping function should be at the Rouse time. On the right hand side, I show you the equivalent GTH inverse for the largest cone angle. And you see that for this particular material, and this is again a different polymer, it's an 8.4 million polystyrene in diethyl phthalate at 6 volume percent. One sees this signature of the type 2 entangled polymers, where the damping seems to be delayed to times of order the fracturability time. However, there's a very fast initial process that looks very much Rouse-like again. So the point of this is that as far as I'm concerned, slip is not an issue in these measurements. But I can go into detail with you on how we deal with slip because this is not trivial. The fixtures used in the rheometer are modified to suppress slip, and I can tell you about that afterwards. Now, another issue that has surfaced in the literature that has been quite worrying in terms of these type 2 materials or type C damping polymers is this question of constitutive instabilities. Ron and Faith Morrison made important contributions to this area, as well as Professor Marucci and Gazzuti. The basic idea is that just as the shear rate, the stress versus shear rate diagram of the Doy Edwards theory is multivalued, the stress versus strain diagram is also multivalued. And so one would expect an instability can exist if the model is true in an actual material. Now, as far as I know, it's very difficult to pinpoint the circumstances where such an instability exists in a rheological test. But what we've done is actually we've conducted steady shear experiments on the very same polymer systems where we measured a damping function. The thought being if the instability is there in the step shear, it should be in the steady shear. But that's sort of a weak argument. But that's what we've done. And here I show you a result for that same 8.4 million polystyrene at 6 volume percent. The first normal stress difference versus shear rate, and the squares are measurements obtained using optical rheology with concentric cylinders. The circles are measurement obtained using mechanical rheometry with cone and plate fixtures. The equivalent result for the shear stress, the steady state shear stress, are given in filled symbols. The results are fitted to a model that was developed recently. And the model uses to describe chain stretch, it uses the expression Manfred mentioned earlier that Ron has used with Tom, or a variant of it that Ron developed with Dave. to determine the stretching. But a key thing is that the fits were gotten by assuming the ratio of the stretch relaxation time, which we've not assigned to rouse or reptation, divided by the reptation time, varying from 4 to 39. And what we find is that the best agreement for the shear stress occurs at a ratio of about 4. All right? Now recall that this polymer had about 13 entanglements. So any sort of guesstimate of the longest rouse time would not give you a ratio of the two time scales of order 4. Suggesting that the characteristic time scale of stretch might actually be somewhat closer to that of orientation relaxation than previously thought. Now, I'm finished talking about artifacts. Now, the question is if this is not a result of an artifact, this now meaning the slurred and expected separability, then what causes it? All right, and here are my ideas. I don't hold them very dearly, but they are certainly plausible ideas, in my opinion. The first is that the rouse retraction loses steam. All right, and basically what I've done is just written a force balance on a chain that's undergoing retraction. And usually we are accustomed to thinking of just the elastic part of this thing, the one that's underlined. And so we assume that this force balance should always go to completion, meaning the length should equilibrate on a timescale of order to rouse. However, as many of us know, there's a Pincus law force that's acting on the chain ends. And since there are two ends to a linear chain, that force would be 2kt over A. And if I do the, as Tom would say, the sums, right? If I do the sums, I basically get a difference of E dot U minus 2, right? Or 2 minus E dot U. That tells me the direction in which the chain length should go, whether it should shrink or stretch as a result of this combination of forces. So my proposal here is that perhaps the chain starts off retracting, and then when the effective strain in the chain becomes of order 2, so when E dot U becomes of order 2, the process gets arrested. All right, so this is very similar to the pom-pom theory, the retraction process at the core of the pom-pom theory. So that's one approach. My second proposal to answer this question is maybe the retraction occurs in a narrower tube. Manfred spoke to that quite eloquently using a mostly thermodynamics approach. We developed a fairly simple approach based on the idea that chains retract to retrieve their random coil or random walk structure. And the thought is that if one subjects a system to a strain of amplitude E, the length of a molecule in response to that strain goes like the initial length times E. The tube diameter, assuming a purely uniaxial elongation here, even though the process is one of shear, should then go roughly as the initial diameter times the square root over the square root of E. Now, people have addressed issues of tube diameter anisotropy, indicating that parts will be stretched and part will be shrunk. But our view, as the previous speaker, is that might be too literal. And so we take a very coarse-grained approach and say, what is the effect of the tube confinement? And the point is that the polymer feels a tighter tube as a result of stretching. Well, actually, no. It's assuming that I think this says what it's assuming, actually. Basically, what it's assuming, it's assuming that the tube volume is initially constant. That's correct. But the key assumption in saying that the length doesn't retract is that the coil is a rouse coil, is the coil is a random walk coil that satisfies random walk statistics, in which case the end-to-end distance squared divided by the new tube diameter should be equal to the length. Right? L times A is NB squared for a random walk chain. Yeah, so it's the same. So A equals A naught e to the minus 1 half assumes a constant volume. So if I stretch in one direction, actually it shrinks in the other direction. Right? If I stretch with a strain lambda, it shrinks to the strain square root of lambda. Constant volume, yeah. Oh, okay, good. In terms of the length, though, the main difference in how we arrive at the final form for the length is by saying that, well, the chain retracts in a tube that's actually tighter or skinnier than the initial tube, so it may not need to retract its initial length L naught to recover random walk statistics, which the argument is the driving force for retraction. Instead, if you do the thing, right, it says that it should retract a length of order L naught e to the 1/2. That's strain dependent. Okay? One could do the rest of the work in terms of figuring out what the time dependence of L is, what the stress is in response to this L that's not purely Rouse-like initially, but has this lower, that is purely Rouse-like initially, but has this lower tail that occurs on a timescale lambda s. Okay? Now the obvious question is, what is lambda s? Well, there are a lot of possibilities, and it's very difficult a priori to decide which one of these possibilities should win. And I list some of the possibilities that I think, and you might tell me others. One possibility I think is that lambda s, in the case of mildly entangled systems, could actually be the Rouse time, meaning that fluctuations are large, Rouse-like fluctuations are large enough to basically unload the extra stress that survives after retraction. So the end result is that for polymers of fairly low entanglement densities, you should indeed find that the separability time is of order lambda Rouse, if this argument is correct. Another possibility is that the contour length equilibrates by the same process that the orientation equilibrates, namely reptation. But within that possibility, I can see at least two sub-processes. One is if the reptation occurs on a time scale that's very different from the equilibration of the tube diameter. One could then argue that the reptation time is in fact tau d naught, on which the chain length equilibrates. Alternatively, one could argue that the tube diameter equilibration occurs very slowly. In fact, there's some classic mechanisms based on constraint release that accomplish this. And they're all significantly slower than reptation itself, meaning that on the time scale that the polymer is escaping the tube and hence releasing stretch, N over NE is not N over NE naught, but it's related to the tighter tube diameter as N over NE naught E dot U to the 1/2. In which case, the stretch relaxation time would then be tau d naught divided by E dot U to the 1/2. And I think that's my story, actually, believe it or not. I'm surprised I'm done. So that's what I wanted to say. Someone asked earlier about the materials. Here's a summary of the materials that were used in the work. They're all polystyrenes, all dissolved in diethyl phthalate, which is a good solvent. As an experimentalist, I hate working at elevated temperatures because temperatures mean temperature gradients. And so these measurements were all performed at room temperature. The polydispersed indices are given. I'd appreciate questions. Yes.
Have we made the same experiment for the star black material?
No, but we're very close to doing that.
Okay.
And so I know you have, though, right? I've seen some work, a paper with Osaki, an older paper. Yes. I see. Possibility B, but there are a lot. there are too many subsets and subclasses to answer that without. I'm sorry. So you mean this here? Okay. I see. Yes. But I think that I feel so unsure about the tube dynamics period But I am not willing to say whether any of these possibilities are reasonable. So that's really why I'm here and why I'm talking about this. Is it reasonable? How does one describe the tube? I mean, why is the tube a static object? Is it a pipe? Is the tube a pipe? I mean, I would imagine since the tube is made up of chains that are being deformed in the same way as a test chain, then the tube is not a static object. And if it's not, then how does one describe its dynamics? That's...
No one could have imagined a better introduction to the following two dead speakers than that question that's still happening.
It's still not the question that, what is the rise time of your...
Theoretically, the company claims it's 0.01 seconds. We found it 0.01 seconds. We've claimed it to be about, we found it to be about 0.1 seconds.
Did you make any correction for this position time?
Actually, no. The correction we made is, I suspect, in material choice. We've chosen to work with very slowly relaxing polymers for that reason. So,
but I mean, the first polymer you showed, you got disagreement, this time, strain factor ability between 0.1 and 1 reciprocal second. And the usual rule of thumb is you have to wait for 10 times your rise time before you can.
I don't recall that. I thought the first polymer agreed with time strain factor ability. So you mean this one?
Yeah, probably. Yes.
Okay. Oh, so you think it might be factorable over the whole range of times,
well,
maybe?
I would claim that it's difficult from these experiments to infer a lambda k from these data here, at least for this particular solution. Because if your rise time is 0.1 seconds, then certainly the rise time for the larger step is at least 0.1 seconds.
Yeah, and the terminal time, yes.
And you would have to put into your model here, you need a model to describe what is happening really, because you have to care about the way you get the step.
No,
the
I agree.
Instrument, yeah. The instrument yeah. does not give you a step of 50 shear units. It overshoots if you really.
Ah, well, actually, no.
We measured on the RMS, it clearly overshoots.
Yeah, this is not an RMS, incidentally. So it's I agree with your point, though. And the way we've addressed that actually is that the view is that if the strain imposition rate is faster than the inverse of the Rouse longest Rouse relaxation time, I know you don't like that, but that's the view.
I'm just pointing to the experimental fact that you find disagreement of time and deformation separability between 0.1 and 1 reciprocal second.
No, but my point...
At the same time, you say, it takes me 0.1 seconds to make a step. Okay? So the rule of thumb is you have to wait 10 times the rise time before you can make a good statement about flexibility. Or you have to put in the real straight history of the material. That's my point.
I'll let you guys settle this.
All right.